Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. Following a century of domination by an outside force, the Egyptians reclaimed their territory and began the great period of growth and expansion known as the New Kingdom. Spearheaded by a powerful lineage of aggressive pharaohs, this period is best known as the age that transformed Egypt into an empire. In part one of our two-part study, we will see the rise of Egypt's most powerful female ruler and the fall of its most controversial reformer. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. On Season 2 of the series, we're discussing the great empires of the ancient world, the forces that created and destroyed them, and the lasting legacies they leave behind that help shape our modern world. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, on my author's website, bradykreitzer.com, and your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. On today's episode, we'll be discussing what many believe to be the high point of the Egyptian world, and certainly the birth of the Egyptian Empire as we know it, the New Kingdom. But the New Kingdom is such a big topic. The New Kingdom has so many faces and so many names that you will recognize that we are going to make this a two-part episode. Discussing the New Kingdom is discussing an empire at its zenith, and that's really something we haven't done yet. We've talked about the Mesopotamian empires, but never anything on the scale of Egypt in the New Kingdom. The figures are larger than life, the decisions they're faced with are greater than any others we've seen before in the region. So when we talk about the New Kingdom, we have to make sure that we have set the appropriate groundwork to understand where it comes from, and how the policies that these pharaohs will make really can be implemented to the fullest extent. You really can't understand the birth of the New Kingdom, the size of it, the scope of it, the scale of it, unless you understand the end of the Middle Kingdom. And in the last episode of Wartime, episode 5, we talked in detail about the forces that created the Middle Kingdom, and we touched on, at the very end, the forces that would bring them down. The Middle Kingdom in the Egyptian world is a time of secure borders and therefore economic prosperity. We see culture advance, we see societal advancements, we see the Egyptians living in a time that later descendants will look at as a golden age. It was a time when Egypt, to a degree, existed as an island, so to speak, by itself, enjoying its own culture, enjoying its own supremacy. But we also talked at the end of the Middle Kingdom about the major forces that brought it down. And those forces came from the outside. If you recall, at the end of the Middle Kingdom, we talked about the pharaoh Sesostris. And Sesostris built an enormous amount of super forts in the southern part of the Egyptian world. He was very fearful of an attack coming from the Nubian desert to the south. The primary power at that time was a group of people called the Kermans, coming from a land called Kerma. Now, those forts that Sesostris built were certainly game changers. They were built at a technology we wouldn't see for another 2,000 years in the Roman world. They were constantly garrisoned by hundreds of troops. They let the people of Egypt sleep soundly at night. But if you just focus on those forts, you'll see where the fall of the Middle Kingdom comes from, and where the rise, more importantly for today's episode, of where the New Kingdom comes from. Those forts, as strong as they were, with moats and walls, and indefensible as they were, will eventually be taken over by the very people they were meant to defend against, the Kermans. And here's the most shocking thing for us as historians. They seem to have been taken over with absolutely no struggle at all whatsoever. It seemed like over the passage of time, the outsiders, the barbarians, as the Egyptians would have seen them, the foreigners, the Kermans, simply commandeered the fort. We don't see evidence of great battles. We don't see evidence of a great war between them. What we can surmise is that the Middle Kingdom of the Egyptian world was weakening. And it was weakening to the point that a complete takeover of its strongest and most advanced military fortifications happened without even firing a shot, so to speak. So we can use these clues to kind of piece together the bigger story. Now, is there anything new we can discover about the Kerman takeover of Sesostris' forts or the decline that led to the fall of the Middle Kingdom? Regarding those forts, no. Because every single one of those forts that could tell us anything about the event now sits at the bottom of a man-made lake in Egypt that was created by the construction of the Aswan Dam about 50 years ago. So those will be lost to history forever, I guess, in that regard. Those forts will remain undisturbed, but they're under a few hundred feet of water. Now, this slow decline is coupled in a few ways, and the much more meaningful thing to us is how the decline affects the north. Because if you recall, we talked about many of the later Middle Kingdom pharaohs beginning these massive building projects, and again, they felt inclined to do so. Times were good, feelings were strong, economic security seemed to be something that they had to take on these projects. Well, a lot of those projects were completed by allowing in new populations of immigrants from the ancient Near East, people who were not Egyptian, people who were never Egyptian, but people who supplied the pharaoh, supplied the king, with a steady and regular workforce to complete his building projects. Now, as more and more of these foreign workers begin to move in, they become a significant portion of the population of Egypt. And as Egyptian power declines, that same decline that allowed the Kermans to so easily take over the superforts of the south, it's very likely that these immigrant populations rose in power as well. So much so that the Middle Kingdom pharaohs will lose dynastic control altogether, and Egypt will fall into about a 100-year period of rule by a group of outsiders who were not Egyptian at all. We touched on them briefly at the end of the last episode. We called them the Hyksos. Now, if you were to take a time machine back to the ancient world and ask specific groups of people, who are the Hyksos? Where can I find the Hyksos? You wouldn't really get a great answer, because these people certainly didn't call themselves by that name. Hyksos is a Greek version, a Hellenized version, of the Egyptian term Heka Hasau, which basically means the foreign rulers. So the name Hyksos is an Egyptian derivation. It means foreign rulers. But for over a century, these non-Egyptians ruled over Egypt. And it wasn't necessarily a painful arrangement. It wasn't a hostile takeover. But there certainly were elements of fighting involved in this. If you are an Egyptian living during that time, though, in your mind, your kingdom, your world has been taken over by an outsider. You are no longer in control of your own destiny. And the Middle Kingdom ends with the rise of foreign rule in Egypt. We say this is the first great catastrophe to ever befall the Egyptian people. And it will fundamentally change who they are and how they view their own world. At this time, during the Middle Kingdom, Egyptians live in what I like to describe as blissful ignorance. They have built strong defensive positions on their borders. They feel safe. They feel secure. They know there's a much larger world out there, but they aren't necessarily concerned with it. Again, remember, for the Egyptians, the Nile River is everything. It makes them feel safe. It makes them feel secure. It gives them a societal confidence not seen anywhere else in the ancient world. Remember, they have a system for them that works. Now, we like to say they're living in maybe something of a bubble. Again, blissful ignorance. Because with the emergence of the Hyksos, they learn the hard way. They are not alone in this ancient world. They are not the only powers of this ancient world. And eventually, the other groups of people, who we'll talk about in later episodes of Wartime, are going to want a piece of the action that they've had a monopoly on, the Nile River, for so long. For 100 years, the Egyptians will be out of their own power. They will be second-class citizens in their own world. But very quickly, they begin to emerge as a people with a plan. Now, the Hyksos, when they dominated Europe, really controlled northern Egypt, which we would call Lower Egypt. And again, that's based on how the river flows, south to north. But in the south of Egypt, in Upper Egypt, you do see something of what we could describe as a survivor state for about a century. These are people who live under the old Egyptian ways. This is a real sort of last resort holdout of Egyptian culture. Now, for most of this takeover, they are not powerful enough or substantial enough to fight off the Hyksos. They just aren't. But over time, they begin to develop, and over time, they begin to grow until eventually they believe they can host their own rebellion to them. They would say revolution to take back Egypt. Now, how this is fueled is interesting, because what you're talking about is a period of over a century, and no one's really alive from the time the Hyksos take over to the time the Hyksos will be expelled. You don't see one person surviving that lifespan. So the people who are going to rebel against the Hyksos in Egypt, the people who are going to take back their kingdom, were people who never knew the world before the Hyksos emerged. They've only heard stories. This is not indifferent in the American sense than hearing stories about the glories of the 1800s, of the 19th century. No one remembers what it was like. No one was there. But we have this vision in our mind that we can rebuild it. And we'll often try and rebuild it in the image that really wasn't representative of what it was really like. We rebuild in the image we think it's like. And for these survivor state Egyptians in the south, that's exactly what they're going to do. They're going to expel the Hyksos. They're going to rebuild Egypt. But they're not going to rebuild it as it was before. None of them were alive for that. They're going to rebuild it in the way they think it was before. The way, collectively, they remember it the way it was before. This is not actual memory. This is not you remembering where you put your keys. But this is what we describe as historical memory. How do we, as a people, think about the past? Well, very rarely do we actually consider it the way it actually was. That very rarely happens. It's just a quality of humanity we have to accept. But for these Egyptians who expel the Hyksos, they're going to rebuild Egypt the way they always wanted it to be, rebuilding it to the golden age or glorious age they believed that the Middle Kingdom was. What they rebuild is nothing like the original Middle Kingdom. But 2 to 3 generations later, they do expel the Hyksos after over a century of domination. And we see the beginning of what we can describe as the New Kingdom. Now, what does this New Kingdom look like? Well, the first pharaoh of the New Kingdom that we're going to talk about is a pharaoh named Amose I. And when Amose I takes over, he takes over with a vengeance. He has the position of pharaoh. He was one of the primary leaders in commanding this reconquest of the Egyptian world. And when he takes over, he uses the traits that put him in power to stay in power. He was a great military leader. He was a true nationalist, so to speak, for the Egyptian world. And he uses those qualities to rebuild his empire. The New Kingdom pharaoh is very different, and Amose I will begin this, than the previous pharaohs before him. Because unlike previous pharaohs, who really embodied a lot of the Egyptian values of stagnation, they didn't like change, they didn't want change, the status quo worked for them. The New Kingdom pharaohs embrace new change. They are warlike, they are expansionist, they develop a hyper-aggressive foreign policy. Because the world they used to have was built on the idea that they were alone, that they were untouchable, that this good thing they had could never be disturbed. It was that very way of thinking that brought the Middle Kingdom crashing down. So the New Kingdom of Egypt will be bigger and better than ever before. The New Kingdom pharaohs are no longer content to just defend their borders. No. If there is a threat to them, if there is someone who can attack them, they'll be proactive. They'll go to them first. They'll lead campaigns of conquest. By the time this is over, Egypt, that civilization that really centered around the Nile River Valley alone, will expand all the way to modern Libya, all the way far south to the modern Sudan, and as far north as the modern state of Syria. They will become the dominant superpower of the ancient Near East in the New Kingdom. They will be, for the first time, an empire. And that's something they've never had to deal with before in Egypt. They've been a strong kingdom, they've been a dominant power, but the difference between an empire and a kingdom, or an empire and a regional superpower, is immense. Because with the empire comes the responsibilities of empire, comes the challenges of empire, comes the questions that all imperial forces in the world have to confront. And as an imperial historian, I can tell you it's very much trial and error. Because there really has been no precedent for what an empire this size should be at the time. And the new kingdom pharaohs will address these issues and address these problems the only ways that they know how. Sometimes the answers are the right ones. Sometimes they're the wrong ones. But all of this allows us to profile power in the ancient world, because the dilemmas that the new kingdom pharaohs will face will be dilemmas that all imperial forces, all the way to modern day, will face as well. Now, there is a myriad of new kingdom pharaohs we can talk about, and they are a relative who's who of power in the ancient world. We will split the new kingdom into two different parts, and we'll highlight the careers of four different pharaohs over the next two episodes. All of them you've heard of at least once, one of them everyone knows about, but probably not the reason you think. On today's episode, we're going to discuss two leaders who give us two very different perceptions of power, and how you apply that power and keep that power in the ancient world. One of the great disasters of imperial history is the notion that you always have an heir until you don't. Their system is built on a patrilineal genetic lineage, father-son, oldest male heir rule. And you would be amazed at how simple that sounds, but how few empires ever really have that security all the time. And it's very unusual, and this is a trait of the Western world we'll see for millennia in the future. You have a strong king. If he has a son, he's done his job. If he doesn't, however, it's a great uncertainty that hangs not only over his head, but also the heads of the entire kingdom. It's something that the Western world has to deal with in every imperial form. The notion that you have to have a son, you have to have an heir waiting in the wings, prepared to take over. But what if, instead of a son, you had a daughter? What if you had a wife? What if there is a female who was just as capable, if not more capable, than any man in line of succession? Someone who could take over and lead your people well. Well, in the ancient world, that just doesn't happen. You will not see a woman, you will not see a female inherent power in any way, shape, or form. And it's a really unfortunate detriment to the ancient world, because there's obviously no difference between a man's capabilities to lead and a woman's capabilities to lead. And the person we're going to talk about here in the New Kingdom reveals us that even further, that even in the ancient world, female instincts still reign supreme. So who is this figure we're dealing with? Well, it's going to go to the kingship of a pharaoh named Thutmose II. Now, Thutmose II has all of the challenges and all of the worries that every other king in the history of the world has. Does he have a secure kingdom? Yes. Is he helping to build the empire? Yes. But most importantly, does he have an heir apparent? Well, Thutmose II does have an heir apparent. He has a son, and that son will become Thutmose III. But the problem is, Thutmose II will die before Thutmose III really is old enough to apply power in any meaningful way. When Thutmose II dies, Thutmose III is still a very young boy. He's not yet 8 years old. An 8-year-old boy or younger is not old enough to take over as the kingdom, but he is the rightful heir. Now, if that sounds ineffective, if that sounds inefficient, it is. It's terribly ineffective. So what do you do? Well, this is something we'll see done in all kingdoms and all empires throughout the history of the world. And it's something that we can introduce here so we can reference later. It's one of the reasons we're talking about this story. But what you have when you have a king too young to rule is a position developed we call regent or co-regent. And this is a person who is not king. This is a person who is not in power, so to speak, but it is a person who makes the important decisions in the place of the king until he's old enough to make the decisions himself. And the person who steps in as co-regent after the death of Thutmose II is the wife of Thutmose II, a woman named Hatshepsut. Now, what's unique about Hatshepsut? Well, Hatshepsut was the queen of Egypt. She was the wife of the king. And when the king dies, Thutmose III takes over. But Thutmose III is not her son. Thutmose III was the son of King Thutmose II and a harem girl. So what you have is, I guess you could say, the stepson of Hatshepsut being the pharaoh of Egypt, too young to make any decisions. So Hatshepsut will have probably a good 10 years in power as co-regent to make decisions based on what she thought her late husband would do and what she wanted to do. And as she put herself in that position, what the people of Egypt quickly found was that she was not only a competent ruler, but she was perhaps one of the single greatest rulers they've ever had. So the story of Hatshepsut is one we'll talk about now. Many say Egypt's female pharaoh, or Egypt's great pharaoh queen. She was never pharaoh, not the way we think of it. That was always her stepson, who was too young to take over. But she had the reins over practical decisions and practical control. So that's why we'll talk about her. Hatshepsut is endlessly fascinating, and also a very tragic figure to a degree. So, when Hatshepsut takes over, she realizes some of the challenges that she faces. Number one, the most obvious, she's a woman. And in a time as precarious as the New Kingdom, she's absolutely positively got to make her gender a moot point in her decision-making, because she can't apply her power without the support of the people. What she begins to do is take on the physical appearance of a man, to put that aside so that when she makes public appearances, that you don't have this cultural shock to the group she's addressing. She wears a long prosthetic beard, like all pharaohs would at the time. She begins to take parts of her female anatomy. She begins to compress them, wear baggier clothing, take them out of the equation. And after she does that, she begins to make some very big changes. She moves economically into a region known as the Land of Punt, which we aren't exactly sure where that is, but we know that it was highly profitable for the Egyptians. Economically, she leaves them in a good place. But she also understands, and we've touched on this in every single episode we've talked about dealing with ancient Egypt so far, that if you want to be a pharaoh that's respected, if you want to show your power, if you want to prove that you are an effective administrator, there is an undeniable cultural link with power, with success, and with building. It seems strange to us, but in the Egyptian world, the more you build, the more physical, palpable legacies you leave behind on the Egyptian landscape, the more respect you will have. So Hatshepsut is not only known as one of the great administrators politically and economically in Egyptian history, but she, posing as a man, becomes one of the most prolific builders in Egyptian history as well, which are some of the great lasting legacies we have today of her reign. Hatshepsut has a very interesting relationship with an architect in ancient Egypt named Senemut. Senemut is not a royal man. Senemut is a commoner. And by all accounts, you don't have to be a brilliant historian to figure this out, they were lovers as well. You don't really see that written anywhere, but they were. And Senemut will design for Hatshepsut incredible palaces and incredible temples, really built in a style that was highly modern and unseen yet in the Egyptian world at all. But Senemut will build these structures, many of them still in existence today. But the reason he doesn't is not because he's paid, it's not because he's trying to glorify the pharaoh. He designs them and builds them out of his love for Hatshepsut. And again, he is not royalty, but the temples that he constructs still stand today as the only temples ever built in Egypt for the love and admiration of the pharaoh. The unique relationship between them, interestingly enough, is there. And you know, it's funny, when you go to these temples, I think this is one of the most bizarre stories in the history of archaeology, but particularly near Hatshepsut's temple, the Great Temple, you can see images of it on Google. It's very overwhelming. Colonnaded, three-tiered structure built into the side of a limestone mountain. The workers who built it in the caves around the structure actually left what we would consider to be fairly modern perceptions of graffiti. And some of the images they drew were very sort of unflattering and scandalous depictions of Senemut and the Queen Hatshepsut engaging in less than savory activities. You can imagine what we're talking about. Clearly, the Bart Simpson of the ancient world was at work. But you can see that, yes, people knew she was a woman. Yes, people knew there was probably a romantic relationship between them. Nothing terribly romantic about those images, I can assure you, but they were there. So fascinating stories. Hatshepsut, one of the great figures of Egyptian history, but also one that's almost lost to Egyptian history. And that's what we'll talk about next. Because when Hatshepsut really hits her stride in construction, Thutmose III, the young pharaoh, is old enough to reign. And when he does so, he takes over with a vengeance. Remember, Hatshepsut was not his biological mother. Thutmose III was the son of the pharaoh and a harem girl. Hatshepsut was not his mother. And for most of his reign, he's been overshadowed by his stepmother. And he does everything possible to eliminate her legacy in the Egyptian world. Very unfortunate. But here's how the story goes as we know it. And the details are sketchy, but again, it's one of the pitfalls of archaeology. Senemut, the architect, the lover of Hatshepsut, will disappear without a trace. We never knew what happened to him. We'll probably never know what happened to him. I imagine, though, that the pharaoh had him taken out as part of this power grab that he was instituting, this change in regime, so to speak. And Hatshepsut will disappear as well. Now, we have found Hatshepsut's tomb. We have not found her body, and that's probably gone forever. So we don't know how she died either. But we do know that her stepson, Thutmose III, in order to show his own dominance, went on a campaign of elimination and eradication, dealing with the legacy of his stepmother Hatshepsut. If there was a likeness of her, it was destroyed. If there was a building project she engaged in that was not necessarily integral to the Egyptian landscape, he had that destroyed as well. He wanted to eliminate any knowledge of his stepmother and show that his reign was legitimate. So because of that, the decision of an 18-year-old Thutmose III, 35 centuries ago, we have very little left of this amazing leader Hatshepsut, Egypt's pharaoh queen, but certainly someone meriting discussion, not only because of her achievements, but because of how she took power. It's a system we will see over and over and over again in the ancient world, and one that we'll certainly see practice again here on this season of wartime. Now, what kind of a leader was Thutmose III? He certainly comes to power, in the view of us moderns, as something of a villain. But I don't think that's necessarily a fair way to judge the past. We really, as historians, have to take ourselves out of the story. We're guided by modern sensibilities. We're guided by modern value systems. We cannot apply those to the past. Now, we will inevitably, because all of us have our own biases. But when we understand those biases, when we can work around them and sometimes work with them, we are really acting in our fullest sense as historians. Let's look at Thutmose, not as a villain, not as the man that eradicated his stepmother's legacy, but as a leader himself. And what we'll say is Thutmose III, and maybe it was something to do with the fact that he felt overshadowed by his stepmother for so long, began a campaign of conquest in all directions out of Egypt, to the south, to the north, and to the west. He extended Egypt's borders as far south as Nubia. Not easy, but yet not unheard of. But he also extended the borders as far north as modern Syria. So he, more than any other pharaoh of the ancient world, we can say, through brutal military conquest, probably did more to expand the geographic framework of Egypt, to expand the size of Egypt, more than any other pharaoh. We can say he was responsible for building the land-based part of the empire. Some have called him Egypt's Napoleon for that reason. So Thutmose III does do a great deal to expand the influence of Egypt, but he also performed a great deal to eliminate or exterminate the legacy of his stepmother, who is so fascinating and so meaningful, who ruled before him. So there were many reasons we discussed Hatshepsut in this episode, not only what she did, but how she did it. Having power is one thing, keeping it is another. And that's something that Hatshepsut, to her credit, did for more than a decade, but probably not as effectively as some other people could have at the time. The next pharaoh we're going to talk about from the New Kingdom is a man who would keep power, by literally changing the game to suit him. And in that way, we'll see it done many, many more times throughout the history of the ancient world. What we'll see about a generation later, after Hatshepsut and Thutmose III, is the rise of a pharaoh named Amenhotep IV. And Amenhotep IV takes over when the new kingdom is really at its zenith. They have a system that works, they have a power that works, they are an empire, and they have a clear set of guiding principles. Now, when Amenhotep IV takes over, like all pharaohs, he wants to make his own mark. But what he finds is that the pre-existing structures of power in New Kingdom Egyptian society are growing to the point that he, as pharaoh, can be challenged on many different issues, and here's why. The god Amun-Ra has become the chief deity of Egypt. That has major political consequences, which may not be readily apparent first, so we'll talk about them. But because Amun-Ra becomes the chief deity of Egypt, that means that the temples dedicated to Amun-Ra in the capital of Thebes are now major political centers of decision-making, and more importantly, the priests of Amun-Ra. Those priests who dedicate their life to the worship of Amun-Ra become incredibly powerful in their decisions, because as Amenhotep is pharaoh, if he says, I'd like to make this decision, they can band together and say, Amun-Ra does not agree, or that conflicts with Amun-Ra's vision, and there you see as pharaoh, Amenhotep's power is questioned. That had developed throughout the New Kingdom. That was deeply ingrained in Egyptian society. And for Amenhotep, he was faced with a decision. Do I allow this to occur, or is there a way I can further consolidate power in my hands and strip power from the priests of Amun-Ra? Well, he does this, and he engages in a series of reforms that will turn Egypt on its head. We call them the Amarna reforms. We'll stress throughout this series, there are ways you can get power, and then there are ways you can keep power, and they usually don't go hand in hand necessarily. So the faster you gain power, probably the quicker you lose it. If you take the time to slowly build your power base, it will be yours for quite some time. Amenhotep opted for fast power, and he also would lose it relatively quickly as well. So what changes does he make? Well, in the Egyptian world, they are a polytheistic society. The god of the sun is Amun-Ra, the powerful god that therefore has created these powerful castes of priests. But the sun itself, the sun disk, is a relatively low-level god known as Aten. And Aten is like, you know, your minor league baseball team in the Egyptian world. Aten is well known, but Aten is not necessarily a power broker of the divine. Well, what Amenhotep will do is say, I am eliminating the worship of Amun-Ra, therefore stripping power away from the priests of Amun-Ra, and I am putting our primary emphasis on worshiping only the Aten, the sun disk itself. He makes Egypt, at least officially, monotheistic for a time. Now, how many people believe in this? It's hard to say. But officially, according to the state, Egypt is monotheistic. They now worship the Aten. His name, Amenhotep, will be changed. Amun is in his name, Amenhotep, Amenhotep. And he changes it now, not Amenhotep, but Akhenaten. And the word Aten is in his name. Akhenaten literally means pleasing to the Aten. So this is what we'll see Amenhotep do. So let's just review. He fundamentally changes the way the Egyptian people worship for the sole reason of consolidating his own political power. If that sounds like a problem to you, it is one. It's a way to gain power very quickly, but it's not a very effective way to hold on to power. Akhenaten, or Amenhotep, becomes one of the most unpopular pharaohs in history. But the change doesn't just stop there. He says the capital city of Thebes is the center of this Amun-Ra priestly power base. I want to change completely. He abandons the city of Thebes, he finds an empty place in the desert surrounded by mountains, and he says, I want to build a new city here. There's nothing there, but he wants a new city there, and he wants it to be his capital city. That city will become known as Aka Tauten, which means the horizon of Aten, the rising, you can say, of Aten. And he builds his city there. And very quickly, 20,000 people are in that city. It becomes one of the biggest, if not the biggest, cities of the ancient world. And there was nothing there before. He has fundamentally changed the landscape of Egypt. Why? For the desire for political power. Now, the relationship with Amenhotep, now Akhenaten, and the Egyptian people are greatly stressed for a lot of reasons. One, he's spending a lot of money. Two, he's having them basically relocate their capital city to suit his needs. This would not be any different in the American reference today than if, say, George W. Bush in 2005 moved the capital city from Washington, D.C. to Texas. I mean, it's that big of a change. It's a major shock to the Egyptian people, but it's on the will and the whims of the pharaoh. So it's done. But Akhenaten does everything possible to consolidate power under his control, even to this point. He'll tell the Egyptian people, all of you before could worship and pray to Amun-Ra. You could all do it. You can't do that anymore, though. You have to worship the Aten. But not only that, no one can pray to the Aten directly except me. That's what he says. So whatever relationship you had with your god is now finished, and you can never have a relationship like that at all. He says if you want to pray to the Aten, to the sun disk, you first pray to me, and if I choose, I'll pass your prayers on to the Aten himself. So this is what Akhenaten does. It makes him a very fascinating character for us as historians, but a terribly unpopular character as a result. These are called the, again, Amarna reforms. It's a major change in direction for the Egyptian people, and it's not one that's terribly popular. Moving forward, the Amarna reforms, these changes put forth by Akhenaten, will die with Akhenaten. He will have a son he names Tutankhaten, the living representation of Aten. That's what that name means. But when Akhenaten is out of power, when he's gone, when he dies, that young child, Tutankhaten, will realize the venom that Egyptian society kept toward his father, and he'll undo all the reforms. He'll move the capital city back to Thebes, he'll reinstate Amun-Ra as the primary deity, and Tutankhaten, the name means the living representation of Aten, will change his name to Tutankhamun, the person we know, of course, as popularly King Tut. So that's where that comes from. And we'll talk about King Tut in great detail in the next episode. You all know him. You probably aren't sure why. But what this episode was about today was twofold. Again, it was about reviewing some of the high points of this new Egyptian empire, the new kingdom, this great shining beacon of power in the ancient world. But it was also about expressing views of power, how you gain power and how you keep power. Sometimes there are creative elements of this, as we saw in Hatshepsut. Sometimes, however, a little more force is necessary. The general rule in the ancient world is this. If you gain power quickly and painfully, you'll lose it quickly and painfully. Akhenaten is the example we have. But if you grow your power, if you take time, if you do it the right way, build a solid foundation and work from there, your power will last your entire life. You can change the world as you know it. Now, we'll see throughout the ancient world, many people opt for a brutal, hostile takeover of a foreign land. It'll gain you power quickly, but you'll never keep it. Others will, as we talked about before, assimilate power in that way. Hatshepsut, as co-regent for her stepson, too young to take over, did a great deal with the positions of power that she had. Akhenaten, or Amenhotep, who took over with political power on his mind, made a lot of very difficult decisions that ultimately made his own reign one of the most controversial and one of the most despised in Egyptian history. You know, the end of Amenhotep's rule is actually quite sad, because when you go through ruins and tombs that were built in his time, you're going to see a lot of things in common, and one of them is this. Typically, if a priest or a general or a leader who is in power during a pharaoh's reign dies, his tomb is decorated with hieroglyphs inscribed with images of the pharaoh all around it. But if you look at the people who were buried in Akhenaten's time, you'll see that throughout every temple and every tomb, Akhenaten is actually scratched off of the walls. They took chisels and they carved out his face, so you'll never see it. If there was a likeness of him or a mention of him, it was eliminated. And this seems like maybe minor graffiti to us today, but you have to understand in the Egyptian world, what you leave behind in that form are your legacies. The only evidence that you ever existed in the future, and they knew this, okay, were these representations of you on the walls, were these things left behind. And by systematically expunging the historical record of Akhenaten's existence, by eliminating these marks and by eliminating these representations of him, what they were effectively doing was trying to eliminate him from existence, trying to not only tarnish his legacy, but eliminate the notion that he had ever even been around. There was no greater dishonor in the Egyptian world, in a culture that is really, in a lot of ways, centered around the great beyond, the great culture of death in a way, and life everlasting in the great beyond, than eliminating those pictures. So there is a degree of sadness when you discuss the story of Akhenaten, but there is also a lesson to be learned. On the next episode, we'll discuss part two of our evaluation of the New Kingdom, King Tut's tomb, and Ramses the Great. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.